cool.
So fun.
Oh, you missed a lot of fun.
We heard it, and I was like, what? We just had too much going on.
Here.
So what we'll do then is we'll have three that look like that one in the back, and then I'll bring this one over, and we'll have two on the other side.
Boy, this is serious orchestrating.
This is serious orchestrating. You know,
it's
the rooms.
Reverse the two rooms. The wolf room is there.
This is saved, and wolves are next door. Hello, Winifred. Did I get your name right?
You did.
Good.
Here.
Oh, you want to do it?
How are you?
Yeah.
Good.
I want them to. There to be two that look like that back one, and then this one is going to mirror that one. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to my Friday session. My name is Anna Mercedes. I come to you from Central Minnesota, and this is the last of five sessions that I'm doing on contentious topics in theology and gender. Today's word is saved. And I chose this word because it functions in contentious ways in contemporary U.S. society. I'd like to unearth a little of that by simply asking you the question I used in the advertisement for today's session. That is, are you saved? And how does that question make you feel? Are you saved? And how does that question make you feel? I'm hoping that I could get at least six responses to help us get a sense of how this word saved functions for us. Yes.
I hope.
You hope?
I hope.
Okay, and how does the question make you feel?
A little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
A little uncomfortable.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
It always makes me feel like there's just this grand division. He's over here and he's over here. And, you know, which camp are you in?
Okay. Let me find a pen and get some of this down. So, are you saved? This is a hope. And it comes with some discomfort. But there's also a sense of different camps. And when you say these over here and these over here, who are these and who are these?
Well, I would think the person asking that question feels they're in the saved camp.
Right.
And they wonder which camp I'm in.
Right.
And whether they can associate with me because of that or not.
Sure. Thank you. That's very clear. It's become a code word.
So I'm not a Christian or a religious person, and so I don't consider myself saved, but I don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I'm not scared. Like, I'm not saved.
Right, right. No anxiety. So no.
And with no anxiety.
And has this word been thrown at you, or this question been thrown at you by others at any point?
No, I've never been in very religious
settings
until 3 days ago. So
okay, and I think you can pretty much trust that here at Holden, no one is going to approach you with this question.
I can't be sure.
But this different camps thing tends to characterize different kinds of Christian groups, and there are certain Christian groups, kind of like Holden, who just wouldn't ask. Whether it's because there's a lot of quiet Scandinavian influences, or because Lutherans often are not. Well, not all Lutherans, but folks who are here and do associate with Christianity, which isn't all of us, often aren't so concerned about making the camps. But there are certain Christian groups where this question is thrown at you as an introduction. And I've had that happen. I walked in, and before my name is asked, that's asked. If I'm saved, I don't think that's going to happen. No, here. Anna.
That brings about three other questions for me, which is, or maybe assumptions. So if someone asks, you if you're saved, that means that you would personally know whether or not you were.
Oh.
And if you weren't, then maybe you could do something differently to be saved, which is also maybe a reason why in a lot of Lutheran circles it's not asked, because the assumption is that there's nothing you can do.
Right.
And then that also kind of brings about the question for me, like, what are we being saved from? And
good.
Does that mean that people who aren't saved have succumbed?
Thank you, Anna. We are going to come back to this from what question in just a second. That's very helpful. Yep, okay, we'll come back to that one too. Do about it. Okay, so this thing that Anna is signaling for us is showing us that for people who have been really incorporated in Lutheranism, we have these strong reflexes about thinking that there's anything we do that contributes to a sense of salvation we have. Whereas for some other Christians, there's a really rich sense that we do contribute to our salvation. But for Lutherans, often there is not. So is there anything I can do about it? Okay, let's see if I can get two more out there. We've got all this energy. Okay, we'll just take about four more. Go ahead.
When I was a teenager in Orange County, I grew up Lutheran, but we would go to Calvary Chapel on Saturday nights for the concerts, like Fanny Stillhill and Keith Green, and there was always an altar call.
Okay.
And are you saved and are you born again was interchangeable in those days. And we knew as Lutheran teenagers that that wasn't our language and that we didn't need to be born again, but we were told over and over by the Calvary Chapel people that we didn't go up to that altar call and get saved as, you know, from our own grown-up perspective as opposed to childhood baptism, we were going to hell.
Okay.
So it was just, we didn't believe it, but we also were really disturbed. Because we were told over and over again, if we wanted to be in that community, then we had to get saved.
I'm writing down two things. Is this a language those of us here speak? And those of us in this room, that's a very diverse those of us. And then it also sounds like there was some pressure to this language. And maybe kind of a scare tactic isn't quite the right word, but you
can. Yeah,
you
no, see. It was, I felt it was a scare tactic.
Okay.
And they still do that.
And for some Christians, this is very functional. I mean, this is kind of part of the energy of faith. But again, not so familiar to worship the whole. Yes.
Well, this is building on a joy, and the person back said that whatever we're being saved from, it presupposes that somebody knows what we're being saved from.
Uh-huh.
I'd rather, I think of myself as being on a continual lifelong search.
Uh-huh.
Like Socrates, Plato said, the unexamined life is not worth
living.
Uh-huh. But the search is, it's the journey and the search that's important, that not so much the destination. Because I can't define the destination.
Right. So this raises the question, is salvation, or the state of being saved, is that a destination, or is that something we're participating in an ongoing way all the time, for those of us who associate with that word? So these are all good questions, and you're kind of ahead of me. You're already sort of at the end of the session. You're very, very good folks. Go ahead.
I notice when I'm in meetings, I get bothered when Jesus doesn't come up. And there's something about this question that focuses so much on me, and I know that's
mm-hmm.
some of my bias, but it isn't really about a relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. So your reaction to the how does it make you feel thing is well, gosh, that's such an individualistic question. Or
yeah,
it's
anthropocentric,
not.
And yeah.
All right. So it's anthropocentric, it's focused on humans.
And individual is a good word, yeah, not relational.
I can't remember if that should be an O or an I or an A.
Right.
All right, good, we'll stick with the O. Okay, now, Connie, are you waiting to get in?
I was just thinking that I have no idea what this word is.
Yeah, good.
No idea whatsoever, and it seems like an event horizon of some sort.
Ooh.
This is, I just can't imagine.
I really like the phrase, an event horizon. We might come back to this. But also, I think you're speaking to this. You know, what does this word even mean? Is this a language that even 50% of us in the room would use? I feel like there was, all right, can I move on to it? Yes. Is there anybody over here? I thought I saw a hand.
Oh, I was just going to piggyback on the rebirth and are you born again before
yeah.
the person did. My uncle liked this line well enough and he wrote it down. I don't know where he got it from, but have you found Jesus?
Uh-huh.
And of course the answer is, I didn't know he was lost.
Yeah, see, Christians divide up in different ways, deciding that they need to find Jesus, deciding that Jesus needs to find them. For some Christians, they don't even use a lot of Jesus language. And there's just so many variations of thought around Christian ideas of salvation. Now, is there anybody else out there who wants to jump in before I move forward?
Is there,
our moms isn't already listening.
Yeah, isn't that like a sufficient miracle? I mean, whoa.
Yes, there are lots of feminist critiques. So for those of you, who are joining me for the first time, the work I do is grounded in feminist theology. So Connie is wondering then what my specific field brings to this question. And there's actually quite a lot that feminist theology brings to soteriology, that is to ideas about being saved. But what I want to bring specifically today is the feminist contribution that would say that salvation is an ongoing relational event. And so that is connected. That would involve all of the things that happen in our human bodies. It also resonates really strongly with what you were saying, that instead of salvation being an end point, it's a thing we're doing now or not, or to some degree. Now, those of you who have strong Lutheran gut muscles are thinking, we can't be doing salvation. Salvation is not in any way something we do. So for me as a feminist Lutheran, I'm always looking at the creative tensions and possibilities between feeling like we in all ways rely on God for salvific energies and feeling like God relies somewhat on us. And that is not a comfortable Orthodox Lutheran claim. But I have found that there are ways that I can find, even within my own Lutheran theology, an idea that God has invited us into co-creation, that God's total gift to us, and I realize I'm speaking very much here as an insider to a Lutheran circle, God's total gift to us activates something. And I, for instance, get very excited when it's time to preach on the Lucan Gospel. So for those of you who are in lectionary-based churches, there's this weird cycle we go through where there's a Luke year every third year. Now, Luke is tied into Acts, and Luke and Acts, these two books, have this really dynamic sense of the Spirit infusing the people. And so I've found that that idea of a Spirit-infused way of looking at salvation does tie into feminism. But it's a hard road, and they don't have to agree. I mean, Luther and feminism are two very different conversations. Yes, there's a feminist critique, and the piece of it you'll get today is about salvation being, in some sense, a dynamic event, so like your event horizon, that is happening already now and perhaps also later. That's a feminist idea. Feminists don't agree about it. And so now I'm going to give you some papers that help you delve into some of Anna's questions. So you're already here. You anticipated this before I could catch up with you. People at Holden are awesome. So you may not feel that this saved word is a word that you really want in your vocabulary. And if that's the case, come to this worksheet with the sense of how do I encounter the word saved in the culture in which I live. If it's a very native word for you, then come to this worksheet with the sense of what does this word mean to me? How is it dynamic in my life? And I'm hoping that you might, conversation, be able to fill out at least three of those little zones on your worksheet. Fill out all five if you can. So what are we saved from? When people talk about being saved, what are they saying they're saved for? With whom? With what? And where or when? So work on that on your own for a few minutes. Either how you hear the word functioning or how it functions for you. So what have you decided that this word often indicates when you think about what we're being saved from, or what people who use the term are being saved from? What have you written over there near from?
Separation from God.
Okay, so humanity in Christian teaching is seen as being apart from God, and then salvation brings it as a whole, or us as an individual, back. Okay, so no more separation. What else did you write from Zone?
From yourself.
Say from yourself.
Because we are, I can't think of the word, I've lost.
Egotistical?
But, yeah, that's a good word.
Yeah.
You know, we're self-centered, that's the word I really want.
Right.
We are very, by nature, we are very self-centered.
Yeah, okay. Please, Joy.
So I wrote mortality, and that's not because I think that's what you guys are striving
for. Yeah, but that's
for,
how
but,
it functions,
but,
right?
Yes.
Like
in the outside world, Christians are kind of presented as, you know, well, what do you have for me? Well,
the eternal life people.
Yes.
Right. We're in the eternal life business, right? Like this is like a hereafter thing. I think that's really important to get on the table because for many, many people, for instance, in my classrooms coming in the door, when we start talking about salvation, they think we're talking about an after-death kind of thing. Even if they've been raised in churches, which would challenge that a bit, it's such a strong assumption that salvation is something we trust in for later. So I think that's really helpful. We need to get that out there, that even if some of us in the room have a different nuance, that's a strong way the word functions. Was your hand up, Anne? I thought so.
I was just going to say, like, you know, the common word is that you're safe from the devil or from people, but I would kind of categorize that as, like, from a lack of focus on God. So,
okay. And
that, I mean, this is not, I don't use the word safe very often, but what I've seen it used is, like, if you're straying, you're saved from your straying.
Uh-huh.
Home in, once you're saved, once you get to the other side.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Okay.
It feels to me like, this is partly about nature, as if nature, our bodies, our existence as incarnated beings is somehow a mistake or bad or problematic, and that we're separate from nature, that we are in fact part of creation, part of nature. So I don't know if Genesis says, and it was good, God saw that it was good, and that it's part of it is still good.
Mm-hmm. Good. So you're sort of by nature defaulting toward the feminist critiques here, and that's really good. So you're pointing out again, I think, that this is an anthropocentric way of understanding salvation, that somehow whatever happens to human bodies is different from what's going on with trees, and also that we are fundamentally different. Squirrels, snails, fish, the whole deal. Okay, I'll say a little more about that in just a second. I think this is an important one. What about anybody on this side of the room? From? Okay. Well, you haven't spoken. Go ahead.
Injustices in humankind.
Okay, good, yeah. Actual suffering, actual injustice. That's very good. Go ahead.
I don't believe there's too much I have to be saved from other than my need to take other people's inventory. You know, I need to allow other people to be where they are, who they are.
That's lovely. That's good. Safe from an attempt to control, understand, or define.
Yeah.
I kind of go on with both of those last statements. I call it incivility.
Nice. Okay.
I like the word the ego trip.
Uh-huh.
We're saved from our old self.
Right.
And our old self destroys our bodies, destroys our, we can't see.
Yeah.
It's the base why we are so unjust and destructive.
Very good. Okay, thank you. I need a little more board space, so I'm going to take away these things and put up a few notes about what you've given me so far. The first thing I want to point out is that no one has said the word sin.
Oh, it's on my list.
And I don't have a real strong need for it to be on our common board. I just want to point out that were we doing this exercise in a different period of Christian history, there is no question but that would have been the major thing most people said. Especially in the Middle Ages, there's a heightened emphasis on what we now name atonement theology, and Christians feel good and bad about these theologies. And these themes are already there a long, long time before the Middle Ages, but there's a heightened emphasis on Christ's death, Jesus' death, being functional for us in a salvific way because it is a sacrifice for the sins of humanity. And those of you who our Bible readers and Bible studiers know those themes are already present way before medieval Christianity, but it's at that point that a real emphasis is put on that being the whole reason for the incarnation. And there's other ways to look at incarnation, that being Jesus's, well, the incarnation is shorthand for there being divine presence in skin, not in the human body.
Okay.
Even today, there, I mean, certain groups of Christians would put sin as the first
thing. Right, you're right, exactly. So it's characteristic of a different sort of group that we've got going on here that didn't come out.
Some of you were with me on Tuesday. That's when I would have given you a very brief sense of how I define feminist theology for my students. And this is the acronym I use for contemporary feminist theology. I have other acronyms, ROVA and MELI, that I use for other waves of feminism. So if you're real curious, you're just going to have to find me at lunch, and I will tell you those acronyms. But this one is going to help me talk to you about salvation. This is contemporary third wave feminist thought finds difference to be productive. It's about the empowerment of all people and also planetary thriving. It finds relationality to be central to almost all thinking and living. It's embodied, that is, its activism and its theory starts from our bodies and from the lived experience that we have in those bodies. So if we experience suffering and injustice, that informs the thought that a contemporary feminist thinker would do. So I want you to see then the tensions that are present between this way of thinking and some of our ways of thinking about salvation, particularly in Lutheran circles. Some of what was just said is going to come out really strongly. So the idea that our self dies in the process of salvation, in baptism, for instance, that we're brought to a new self. The idea that our body is sinful, or that our ego would trap us, I experience that very strongly. I mean, I don't disagree. There is a desire that I have for self-transcendence. The trick is that I've had to find a way to understand that I transcend my old self and come right back to my body. Now, I think when I was younger, I thought that being Lutheran meant that I would have to really give everything recognizable as Anna over to God, or that God took that away from me in a salvific way. And that therefore, my body, my whole personality was much more transient, and what really mattered was the godness that was there on the other side. So what we get then is the sense that human bodies are really pretty yucky, that the creation is pretty yucky. And yet there's a tension because, as some other Christians actually will emphasize more than Lutherans do, God is creator for Christians of bodies, of earth. So between here, this real strong emphasis on body and empowerment in the body, and here, where salvation is experienced as a bringing back to God, which implies then that there's any way for us to be unconnected from God, a bringing back to God, a transcendence of our ego. There's some ways that feminists try to work with the idea that, yes, we experience estrangement from that which is holy in the world, and yet we're in a relational web in which God is always present. There's a tension. And feminists try to work in this zone, feminists who are determined to still be Christian, with the idea that somehow a self is shed off like the snake's skin, but a self is still present on the other side too. That God would care very much about the individual uniqueness that is yourself, and that somehow God would be less God if that self weren't there. So there's all these ways that we find tension between traditional Christian ideas of thinking about salvation, especially Lutheran ideas, and the ways feminists will do it. So let's see if we can find some more tension just with one other word. What was a lively word for someone here? Where did you find yourself riding a lot? We've already done from. When. All right, let's work with when. That's a toughie.
Every day.
every day. Good. I've got a feminist who likes that, and I'll read to you from her book in a little while. Every day. What?
A lot of people, the same people that would see, put sin in the other question probably would say eternal life.
Later. Right, later. Okay, so this is a really old Christian debate, very old Christian debate, about whether salvation happens now or later. And that gives me a fine segue to my next thought, but I won't go there yet because we have some more things. Go ahead. That's
so
fine.
The third answer along with it is already.
Mm-hmm. And then the little tag that we often hear thrown on that then is already, but not quite yet, right? I knew somebody was going to throw it out. So yes, truly, already. And that for Lutherans, that's a big deal. It's like some Christians will say, we hope it's later, and some Christians will say, no, absolutely, no more worries. You know, it's already there. But then, sometimes, even though Christians will say, oh, we're already saved, then they get really, really sick, or they don't have enough food to eat, or their kid gets shot. You know, I mean, awful stuff happens. And so then, and this brings me back to what you were saying, I can't remember your name.
Oh, Jeannie.
Jeannie, thank you. I wrote that down. Okay, so what you were saying about real injustice, what do the sorts of Christians who say salvation is already happening mean when they know that people are really deeply suffering? You see, it's if we say salvation happens after death, then we can look at these awful parts of our lives and say, ah, there's resolution later. But if we are people who claim that salvation should be something that is efficacious now, then what the heck do we mean when we get cancer, when we lose those we love? What are we talking about? That's a real tension.
I have heard, because my nephew died of leukemia at 7.5, you know, people would say, well, it's not God that did this to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's the sinful world that happens to me.
Uh-huh.
And so that's sort of, you know, it's kind of run away from church, or, you know, right there. You know, it's a terrible point, like you said, and how do we justify that? And again, we come back to, at least it's happened a variety of times in my life. Well, it's the sinful world.
Yeah.
Sin in us.
And it would also hurt a lot to be told that God did that. I mean, both of these answers are really.
This is an area where I think American Christians, or for you, first world Christians, really have a problem addressing this. And if we were to talk to Christians in poverty, or Christians without clean water, or Christians without any health care at all, there's a lot there to be learned.
Uh-huh.
Because while we have problems, and while we have tragedies, and while we are in pain with our losses, there are many.
You've suddenly generated thoughts on both your right and your left. Anna, go ahead.
Well, so then maybe the idea, if I'm thinking, when I've gone to places, and this is acknowledging that I have lived a pretty charmed life, but when I go to places where people do not have the same privilege as I do, and I'm hearing some of this, like, later language that it helps them get through the shitty now,
mm-hmm.
then maybe the idea of being saved later is presently saving.
Mm-hmm.
That you're able
Good.
To get through your current life.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saved from maybe giving up or not being able to deal with it by the idea of a later redemption.
The writing here is phrase presently saving. So this gets us into the question of whether the concept for us, the language for us, can function already as itself efficacious. Just saying, just knowing this sense of a later, does that change the now? is the idea of being saved later, presently
saving.
Saving, good. Redemptive, right? So in other words, I can have the energy to get through another day like this because I hope them later. They are enough to join.
And so I was going to play the opposite direction of that is interesting, but my understanding is the ruling class tended to say, yeah, God is blessing us now, and so because I'm living the right way, that's why I'm rich. And that it was the lower class who had the apocalyptic, there's going to be a big reversal later on kind of hope. And so as first world sort of people, it's interesting that we've got the system upside down, as that we're seeing that it is something later, even though we've got the blessed now kind of position. Sure, so Jesus turned upside down the structure and we're trying to
keep it. We're trying to grab,
you know, there's also
upside down, back upside down again.
We could have a really fascinating time if we had the chance to break for 3 hours and do some sociological analysis and come back. I think we could have an interesting time looking at the class structures of different U.S. Christian groups. So for instance, mainline Christians and Roman Catholic Christians in the U.S., not all mainliners. Mainline is like a kind of a messy term for throwing together folks like Lutherans, Episcopalians, Methodists, Presbyterians, folks who generally don't classify themselves under the other messy term, evangelical, even though the ELCA has the word evangelical, right? So those folks may tend to be moneyed in the U.S., tend to be. I mean, there's also really poor Lutherans in the U.S., you know, but tend to be. And so then we might have this idea of salvation later that does seem a little odd. But then you might find that there's some moneyed evangelicals. We have the idea of salvation now in much of the mainline tradition, but then there might be wealthy evangelicals who think of salvation as later in a way that plays with that. And then you might also, what I'd be curious to go find, is whether the evangelical base struggles with money more than the mainline base. And I don't know. I'd have to go look. But it's a fascinating thing to think about the way our lived experience around plenitude or lack of physical things that we need, whether that does influence theologies in the U.S. I think it probably would. And then you'd have to also look at cultural background, too. So one of the ways that the ruling class has used the later theology in a really torturous way was during the time of slavery in the U.S. And this is something many of you have already thought about, but white plantation owner Christians would say to slaves who had been made to be Christian on the plantations, they'd been both forced into that, and then, of course, we have this really rich legacy of slave song that says this Christianity also pulls us through. So, you know, it becomes this ambiguous tradition that's both not native to those who had been forcibly enslaved and becomes deeply their own tradition, right? Okay, so what I'm wanting to tell you here is that the white ruling class in that case says, and this is well reported, suffer now, be obedient to your masters, and that is the way you will earn salvation later. And that's just there. That, you know, that this idea that salvation comes later is used as justification for suffering at the white plantation owner's hands now. And then, you know, by some good, odd mercy of God, that same gospel message pulls people to freedom, despite what those masters were doing. But way too many people never saw that freedom and died, and never saw their kids, etc. So this later idea, this matters. And Christians have used the later idea to exploit, to take money, all sorts of things. You know, if you want to earn your salvation, you better pay up.
Joy, you have waited forever. Go ahead.
No, so basically, actually, that's what I was going to talk about.
Oh.
Was part of it was people using that to keep other people down. But then also,
right.
Something that frustrates me is seeing people that are in situations that are difficult, and they seem like maybe they could get themselves, help themselves out of it somewhat, but they say, this is what God wants for me, and to not try to help themselves because it's, for whatever reason, not striving for some kind of improvement in their life is
not
what
God
wanted. So,
good. I have an example of that from this book. So now my segue has happened twice. You're talking about the already, not yet, and then you're talking about people being kind of stuck in a situation. So I'm going to take the segue
And for the rest of our time together, we're really going to be focusing on the tension of temporality within salvation. That is the when question here. Already? Not yet? Both? We'll see. So I'm going to talk to you about just two Bible verses. You do not really have to get engaged with the Bible if you don't want to. You're just not in the mood this Friday morning. But if you do want to engage with the Bible, open it up to 1 Corinthians. This will be brief enough that you can really just listen if you want. In 1 Corinthians, this is one of the letters that Paul wrote. Paul being, you know, early Christian influence, older than the Gospels. And so we get from Paul a sense of the hybridity of Christianity in those early decades. It really wasn't even Christianity yet. It's a form of Jewishness. So look, once you get to 1 Corinthians, look at chapter 7. Now, this letter from Paul gives people who do gender theory, like me, a lot of headaches, because 1 Corinthians is where we get a lot of teaching about women and men and Paul's understanding. And if you just read it, if I just had somehow assigned it to you before you came, you would see that it sounds like it's a pretty restrictive and odd book when it comes to gender. Women are being told to act a certain way and men a certain way. What I want you to see is that if you read that through the lens of Paul trying to figure out with these people whether salvation is now or later, the whole thing starts to mean a whole lot less about gender and a whole lot more about when salvation functions. So things that look like they're talking about how men and women are supposed to live turn out to be statements about whether we really need to worry with some stuff because salvation's coming tomorrow. Paul has this very soon, this imminent sense of salvation. So what we think is happening, we scholars who look back at this text, what we think is happening is that the people at Corinth, when Paul wasn't with them, got the idea of what I'm going to call a realized eschatology. That is the idea that the end times and all the salvation that happens then is already in place. So they got into what contemporary folks might call some pretty heavy gender trouble. They decided that that all women, and if you were with me for the sexuality session on Wednesday, I shared with you that at this time period, there really wasn't a sense of women and men. There was a sense of human bodies that could aspire to a dominant, stable masculinity, and that women were really a mess. They were the bodies that were failing. But they could try to aspire to be more like men by having more stable bodies, you know, not having sex because sex would get them pregnant, and then they're lactating, they're just not stable. So what we see going on is that these people in Corinth seem to have gotten the idea that, hey, salvation is already now, and salvation looks like all being pretty stable men, because that's what God looks like. So we don't need to be doing this marriage thing, and if we are married, we can stop having sex now. You know, we look at that now, and we think, oh, this is so repressive, they don't think they can have sex. But for them, they were like, let's get over that, because we're trying to make our bodies be stable. So you get lines in here where Paul is trying to tell people who are married to stay married. We look at it and we think, oh, divorce, we're not supposed to get divorced. Yeah, okay, that is a contemporary question we can talk about. But here, he's not thinking about the contemporary reasons people get divorced. He's dealing with Christians who are so high on the idea that salvation's happening right now that they don't think they need to be making families or babies or anything anymore. They just want to pray all the time. And it's really not what it looks like if you don't know that background. Okay, so let's look together at 7 in verse 5. Do not deprive one another. It's talking about a wife and a husband here. Do not deprive one another except perhaps by agreement for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. What we think is happening in Corinth is that people have decided to have celibate marriages. They're, you know, they've been together, but they're so captivated by the idea that God has fixed everything and that salvation matters right now that they've just given up on needing to attend to bodily life at all. It's very weird to our modern sensibilities, but you see that's a very different thing than thinking that Paul is just, for arbitrary reasons, giving you laws about how men and women should live together here. Okay, then there's another one very similar to this in 7:10. To the married I give this command, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, so the and that the husband should not divorce his wife. Again, in this context, that's meaning, yes, salvation has come, but I, Paul, think we should keep our social structures in place just for just for a little safety net here. I mean, Paul does not have quite so realized an eschatology. That means he's not thinking that salvation has happened altogether right now so much that we can just throw everything out the window. There's a later place where women are cutting their hair, they're looking more like men. He's not comfortable with that. He wants them to still have a sense of social order. So Paul does have this sense of already there being a redemption, but he's got a little of that not yet too. So this is an example of how there was trouble in Corinth because they disagreed with Paul about whether salvation had come or not. And now I'd like to share with you an example from a contemporary book. This is one I spoke of earlier in the week. It's in the bookstore, Proverbs of Ashes. Violence, redemptive suffering, and the search for what saves us. And here's an example that will resonate with what Joy was saying about people being stuck in a situation and maybe being taught by their churches or faith communities that that situation is appropriate, that that suffering should continue. Salvation's later. This is Rebecca Parker speaking, and I learned from someone else earlier this week that Rebecca's taught in this very room before. A few months after my visit with Pat, a quiet knock on the church office door interrupted my reading. Marking quickly the prayer I'd chosen for Sunday's service, I closed the book of worship and opened the door. A short woman stood on the threshold, bundled up against the chilly Seattle weather. "Hello, Pastor, I'm Lucia." I block and walk by the church on my way to the bus. She gestured to indicate the direction. "I saw your name on the church sign. You are a woman priest. Maybe because you're a woman, you can understand my problem and help me." "Of course, come in," I said. She sat down on the old sofa next to my bookcase with its load of theology texts bending the shelves. She smiled, an expression both warm and sad. "I haven't talked to anyone about this for a while," she began, the smile fading and sadness deepening in her eyes. "But I'm worried for my kids now. The problem is my husband. He beats me sometimes. Mostly he is a good man. But sometimes he becomes very angry and he hits me. He knocks me down. One time he broke my arm and I had to go to the hospital, but I didn't tell them how my arm got broken." I nodded. She took a deep breath and went on. "I went to my priest 20 years ago. I've been trying to follow his advice. The priest said I should rejoice in my sufferings because they bring me closer to Jesus. He said Jesus suffered because he loved us. He said if you love Jesus, accept the beatings and bear them gladly as Jesus bore the cross. I've tried, but I'm not sure anymore. My husband is turning on the kids now. Tell me, is what the priest told me true?" For those of you who are with me on Monday for my truth section, this is an example. Her response coming up here is an example of what Catherine Keller would see as the resolute. A truth, which is true in this moment. Lucia's deep black eyes searched my hazel ones. I wanted to look away, but couldn't. I wanted to speak, but my mouth wouldn't work. It felt stuffed with cotton. I couldn't get the words to form. I was a liberal Christian. I didn't believe God demanded obedience or that Jesus' death on the cross brought about our salvation. I hadn't forgotten another woman, and here she's referring to the story she's already told in the book, a woman who actually went back home and was killed by her husband. I hadn't forgotten Enola Reed, though I thought of my theology as far from hers. But just that past Sunday, I had preached a sermon on the willingness of love to suffer. I preached that Jesus' life revealed the nature of love and that love would save us. I'd said that love bears all things, never breaks relationship, keeps ties of connections to others even when they hurt you, places the needs of the other before concern for the self. In the stillness of that moment, I could see in Lucia's eyes that she knew the answer to her question just as I did. If I answered Lucia's question truthfully, I would have to rethink my theology. More than that, I would have to face choices I was making in my own life. And after a long pause, I found my voice. "It isn't true," I said to her. "God does not want you to accept being beaten by your husband. God wants you to have your life, not to give it up. God wants you to protect your life and your children's lives." Lucia's eyes danced. I knew I was right, but it helps to hear you say it. So there's an example of different theologies at war with each other in a very contemporary way. One theology that will say the suffering in our life is purposeful. It gets us somewhere. God will reward us later. And then one that says, no, salvation is about dismantling that suffering for other people and for ourselves. So these are contemporary things that are at war with one another. And then I have a third example for you, and this is coming from Avoni Guevara, and she's my theologian of highlight for today. You can find this book in the library. Avoni Guevara is a Roman Catholic sister. She
lives and works in Brazil, and her work has gotten her into trouble. She's been silenced by the Vatican before and was actually sent to do a second PhD to sort of correct her. She went and did that PhD, and she's still writing. So she's done two PhDs, and she's just a dynamic and fascinating woman. She has this book, Out of the Depths, Women's Experiences of Evil and Salvation, but that's its English title. And this is one that she wrote in French. She also writes in Portuguese, but in the French, the title is The Evil of Women. And so I tell you that to help you see that she's not, as a feminist, a person who's going to think that women are just super cool and really could rule the world if they were given the chance. Rather, she does believe this, and this echoes with what some of you were saying earlier, that we have an ego we need to transcend, that women hurt each other, that people can't just be set free without some sort of guiding communal ethos. So she writes in this book about awful things women do to each other, and the men, to their children. So she's not some happy feminist that says, hey, women, let's just embrace our womanness. And rather, the same time, she looks at the ways that women still disproportionately suffer in their bodies around the globe. This is just a great book to take home with you from Holden. So now I'll read you a couple of pieces from here. I'm ending my week with stories. I'm finally just sitting down and reading to you. So see how these ideas ring with what you wrote on your paper earlier. She's just had a long section in which she's describing how she sees some women in Brazil suffering, and then she says, the daily domestic reality of evil lived by the poor and especially by women is the hidden evil, the evil without fanfare, the evil that never enters into the annals of a country. The dailiness of this good evil accompanies life's most vital physical needs. This is the location of destruction, the body consumed by hunger, the body dying of thirst, the body homeless, the body wasted by sickness, the body beaten, the body undergoing violence, the body lacking salvation. But there is a concrete salvation, an everyday salvation, a salvation of the here and now, a salvation for this life and this moment. It is a far cry from the grand projects of world economy, official statistics, a religious apocalypse, a far cry from the salvation of heaven and messianic promises. So I think you can hear some resonance with the idea that people who go through a whole week without an acute experience of physical suffering are sometimes in a very different place with salvation than those who are on a daily level experiencing it. And you know, we don't have to go to her neighborhood in Brazil to experience that. That's right here in Washington too, but she speaks a really poignant message because she doesn't live among the wealthy in Brazil. She lives in a very economically depressed place. Okay, so then later in her book, she continues to develop this idea of everyday salvations. Okay, I'm reading now to you from page 123. So if you go buy the book, you can find it again. Claiming the dailiness of salvation. Oh, that's a little too soon. Let's back up. In practice, we must always begin again every day the search for salvation, just as every day we have to begin again the actions of eating and drinking. It is a dynamic movement in the innermost part of our lives. That is, salvation is somehow a dynamic movement in the innermost paths of our lives. This step involves taking another view of the theology of salvation, to see there are redemption in the here and now, a redemption that takes flesh now, even if for the moment the salvation is contained within the limits of our body, our heart, our daily routine. It's everywhere, even in the hell built by the human person, even in suffering and groans of sorrow. It is everywhere, present under different forms, inviting us to go beyond the evil or despondency that torments us. But this salvation is not a state one attains once and for all. It is there like a glass of water that quenches thirst for the moment, but thirst comes again, sometimes stronger than before. It is there like a bit of land that one succeeds in acquiring after much anguish, but then the landowner takes over, and there follows drought or the lack of good conditions for cultivating the land. The moment of the hoped-for salvation comes, sometimes seen, sometimes unforeseen. No sooner it comes than it is gone. It escapes, flying away to prepare another and another. This fragile redemption is what we find in the everyday life of every person. Today it is the story of the life and speech of women. Now here's an interesting place where she tries to tell you that she's not giving up on the idea that there's also a not yet or a beyond to salvation. Claiming the dailiness of salvation is not to deny the possibilities opened by a perspective on the beyond of history. We must keep the tension between this historical present, which is our concrete lived experience, and this beyond, which is the object of the tradition of our faith and hope. But we must be careful not to affirm the beyond at the expense of actual history. And that's where she's saying we cannot enslave people, we cannot make people suffer in their homes of abuse because of this idea of a future. Even if we sometimes feel an existential need in Christian culture for a grander and more universal salvation, a salvation in the beyond, it does not come over us when we are crushed by some enormous actual grief, for example, when hunger eats away at our innards, or when misunderstanding ruins our relationships, or when our child is dead in our arms. Actual experience has a way of changing us, and this is nothing new. It is necessary to add that there is no salvation once and for all, a salvation that would eliminate other problems. We may speak of salvation, but there are only successive salvations in history. Examples drawn from the lives of our witnesses testify to that, and these are witnesses she's shared here. No longer is there any unique model of salvation, such as the social redemption proposed by various political parties, or the way of salvation proposed by various religions or theologies. Rather, salvation seems to be a movement toward redemption in the midst of the trials of existence. One moment of peace and tenderness in the midst of daily violence. Beautiful music that calms our spirit. A novel that keeps us company. A glass of beer or a cup of coffee shared with another. These give us the desire to go on living. Salvation is a bright green garden where vegetables have sprouted after much effort. Salvation is a baby long awaited or a love letter that brings us back to life. Salvation is beauty, a garden on the earth where God walks. So I love this. I love the way she's so embodied here. I don't agree with everything she says, but I love the embodied nature of it. And then I have this friend, Deanna Thompson, who is a Lutheran feminist theologian that I hope some of you have encountered before. And she lives and works in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is a colleague of mine. And she has been struggling with stage 4 cancer for a number of years. And she says to me, you know, we feminists are good at thinking about salvation now as an everyday thing. But she says, I've seen a lot of the insides of cancer rooms, and I need there to be something more. So Deanna is a challenge to me in that I hear Avani saying, salvation is happening now, and it's a process. And then I also hear Deanna saying, hey, Christian community, speak more to me than it's just happening today, because my today isn't so good. So I hear those tensions, this already-ness, this now, and maybe also later. And I have left for you as a closing thing to take home from Holden, if you want, you don't have to, these bookmarks. And I would challenge those of you who don't feel like going to lunch yet to write on one side a moment of salvation you can identify in your own life. I've had some pretty good midnight conversations along the way, for instance, in my life, or some amazing walks out here. Maybe would work for some of you. I've had those walks elsewhere, holding my little newborn in my arms, things like that. I can identify some moments where I have really felt the grace of God, like, there for me. And that's my language. It would be different language for some of you. And then maybe on the other side, to challenge yourself to write something that you really think needs salvation in the world or in your own self right now. So a flip. And I would call this, I have some language, every day and another day. So maybe on one side, if you decide to stay and hang out and do this for a minute, something that could be an everyday experience of salvation that maybe is in your memory, this really blessed, transcendent, and yet really imminent moment. And then on the other side, another day. Some person you know is suffering and needs another day, or something in your own self that just doesn't seem fixable right now. If you want, stay and do that. You've got ribbon from the craft cave for your bookmark. Give it to someone else if you like, and if not, go on and get some good ones.